There we go. Okay. So this is Right About Ancients. It is November the 14th. Okay. So yeah, so that's what kind of where I wanted to start today, was just talking about what does Thucydides have to add to our conversation about the worldview of the Greeks, about what the world was like. Because remember, our whole idea here is using literature as a lens, to looking at literature through the lens of, like, what is this telling us about history, about this time period, about what it was like to be part of this world, part of this culture. And then we also had the two articles that the Scanlon and the Smith articles that also kind of brought in the Thucydides, kind of dove into some of the things I think related to this whole conversation as well. So yeah. What do you guys think Thucydides had to contribute to this overall conversation?
He has a very strong sense of, like, patriotism.
Okay.
The heroes.
Do you think that's somewhat of a new thing? Or just stronger?
Well, I feel like it's either new or stronger, because, like, in the Iliad or the Odyssey, they're more fighting for, like, feels more individual, rather than, like, you're fighting for the cause of your whole. Maybe you're fighting for one cause, but it's not, like, the cause of your state. It's
right.
Like, in the Trojan War, it's all a bunch of different nations coming together to fight, and they're on two sides, but, like, there's not, like, this strong, unified sense.
Cohesion,
like,
yeah.
You're fighting for your country.
Right.
That you see here.
It was more against, okay, we're fighting against them because they've got something Agamemnon wants.
Yeah.
Or it's not so much we're fighting because they're attacking our statehood. Kind of thing. Okay, yeah, that's a really good point. Go ahead.
I thought it showed, in the play part specifically, a more loyalty, but also, like, kind of brutality. Because during the play, that the doctors would visit them, but also family members, and people would still visit the sick, even though they knew that they would probably get sick and die. But also it says that because people were dying, they would do, like, whatever they want. Like, that usually they wouldn't do in the open. They would just do it. And that they would throw bodies and burn them and stuff when they die. So
okay.
It's kind of like there's loyalty, but there's also brutality to them.
So there's a real dichotomy there. What do you think is the... what do you think is the source of that? I mean, and do we have any, like, modern... I guess modern parallels to something like that?
I couldn't think of one, but I know there's something.
How some people can just as quickly, like, be helpful and kind, and then, like, the next day not be. Like, they can switch around, like, they can, I don't know, be really helpful towards a charity, but then, like, treat, I don't know, homeless people badly.
Okay.
Like, I know a person that always gives charity to, what, like, Salvation Army. They're at the church, but then they're very strongly opposed against homeless people and doesn't like them. So I guess, like, that.
Okay.
They're nice, but then also, like, rude, kind of, like, against... people. I mean, it's not the same as what they do in there.
Right, yeah.
So
okay.
Like,
I was thinking, like, it looked like a zombie apocalypse almost. Like, every man for himself.
Okay.
In that
agreeable.
Like, in Athens.
Yeah. So is there an element there of... Because, like, when you have a society that is very strong on social order... And then the social order breaks down. Like, sometimes maybe it's in the case of war, and there's a threat, there is a plague, something like that, that's threatening, so that everything is disrupted. Mm-hmm. Do you think it's that disruption, the fact that everything is out of order, that tends to throw people who would normally behave very differently into, like, almost an opposite kind of behavior than one. It's like, you know, we see this sometimes with like a mob mentality kind of thing. When you have something like Trying to historically, like, well, like the situation where you had someone beaten and killed by, died at the hands of the police. So the police are supposed to be the ones who protect. So social order, social expectation of order has broken down. And so now it's like, now people feel like, oh, now I don't have to respect the law. I don't have to do this. So therefore, the whole mom mentality kicks in, and now you're not a thinking, reasoning person. You're just a reacting person. And so sometimes when people just purely react rather than thinking, they wind up getting caught up into smashing windows and looting and setting things on fire and all of that kind of thing. So is there an element of that, what we think of now as a more of a mob mentality kind of perspective that was happening back then? What were you thinking, Jack?
It's because it's like in thinking and like in logic, intelligence mm-hmm. is what changes people mm-hmm. from regular animals. But once you lose the logic and that, you become just another animal. And driven
yeah.
by like instincts and stuff, and I think that's what was happening, and like
mm-hmm.
that it was kind of showing that heroes are the ones that like rise above. They use their brain, they use their human given thing, the
okay.
logic and intelligence, rather the people that aren't heroes, just that are regular people are animals because they
mm-hmm.
don't have the logic and they're just running on reactions and instincts like.
Mm-hmm.
dog or a cat or
yeah.
bigger wood rather than thinking and doing
what. I think there's something there too, because there seems to be some sort of criticism on like acting rashly and like not using wisdom in making decisions, because
mm-hmm.
there was a lot of contrast between, I think his name was Archidamus, who was considered to be wise, who opposed the idea of going to war with Athens.
Yes.
And then there was more of that in the a debate over whether or not to massacre the Miletans. Mytileneans as well. They said not to act rashly and on anger. And you can kind of see the effect of that in the outcome of the war.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some sort of criticism there on like acting wisely and using your head versus acting on your emotions and anger.
Right.
Which is kind of like what you were talking about.
Yeah,
yeah,
like in the speech in Lacedaemon or Sparta, when you're talking about like being hasty.
Yeah,
it's like a daemon.
Okay,
it's like a daemon.
I never hear these words pronounced out loud. So, anyway, there was something about like not the king. The king stood up and was like saying, "Don't be rash. Don't make,
because
like this has
right.
huge consequences."
Right. I think of things like Kristallnacht in World War II, about where in Germany you had the Night of Shattered Glass, where basically Hitler, the Nazi mindset basically kind of broke loose and got kind of had it. People got caught up into that, got caught up into the kind of the scapegoatism of, and then just going, it turned into basically going through cities and smashing all the windows, looting, destroying anything that belonged to Jews at, definitely kind of people acting rashly, reacting out of fear, reacting out of desperation, and putting, in that particular case, I mean, when you've got something like what was going on with the anti-Semitism and other things, it wasn't just anti-Semitism, but the eradication of basically anyone who had any kind of disability or any kind of like difference in a sense. It was very, very much a misguided patriotism, a very much out of fear, to where the emotion definitely overrides the wisdom, which I like that how you brought that up, Lucy. So thinking back on what we decided, like I'm thinking going back to the even going back to like the Iliad, and could we even, yeah, definitely with the Iliad, I mean, do we have situations where even in a hero where wisdom thought making choices about their actions got overridden by emotion?
He died because of that.
Yeah.
So what would we call this attribute? Like moderation, self-control?
Yeah, I would think, yeah.
Or like,
I was like taking that idea of like that part of what was admired, and I think what we've been seeing as kind of as there a shift in emphasis from before kind of into some of the, we see it in shift from Iliad to the Odyssey already, but I think it's a continued shift here from action to like the intelligence, and then maybe now even further into wisdom kind of idea. I mean, don't we say, because doesn't that seem to be somewhat of a progression of what's going on from the Iliad to the Odyssey to Thucydides? Because, I mean, isn't that one of the, when we're talking about the, because, okay, trying to get my timeline right, Thucydides and the, with the Age of Pericles, are we, we're concurrent there, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
My whole thing is on Pericles.
Yeah, so if we're dealing with, so, like, why is Pericles and Athens in the Age of Pericles, why is that lifted up in particular as the Golden Age? And why, or even just talking about Pericles, why is Pericles lifted up so much?
Because he's got the grip on Athens right now. He's like, he does everything he can to make the people love them, love him, so that he can give everything to the people. So
right. He
kind of has a hard job of maintaining the balance, because the Athenian view of freedom is to balance a life of hard work and enjoyment.
Yeah.
And that's what he was saying all these men died for. That's why their lives are not in vain. I offer comfort, not condolence, to their relatives, because they were great men. But he wants to maintain that, like, well, I guess that almost perfect way of living, and like he can't hold it all together in the
end. Yeah. So in Athens at that point, is the loyalty of the populace toward Pericles, or is the loyalty towards Athens? Because that's the thing. Is like sometimes we talk about can that loyalty or can that unity within a group of people survive the absence of the leader? Whether it's the defeat of the leader, the death of the leader, or whatever, or is it all bound in? No, it's the personal loyalty from the populace to the leader, kind of. Like, and you were, you were kind of reacted to that, Jude.
Yeah, I mean, he seems to, like, Pericles seems to not want them to like honor him, but like honor the state.
Mm-hmm.
He really, at least in the funeral oration, he really seems to like stir up in them a love for Athens versus like having like a cult of personality. So I think that if what he is saying, now what he's saying doesn't mean it reflects what everyone believes or feels, but if it does, then I would think that it's not as much a cult of personality as it is like
Olaf for Athens itself, which is why, like...
Do you think he's trying to facilitate that broader view?
Perhaps.
Maybe?
Perhaps. And, like, other people did that, too. Like, I forgot the guy's name. The one who, like, tried to build up Athens.
Mm-hmm.
And all the buildings and stuff. No, not Solon. No. It was after Solon. And I think it was... Pisistratus. I think it was Pisistratus. Who like tried to build all the buildings and stuff to give people a pride for Athens versus like, you know, being attached to like a demagogue.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I see it.
Okay. Where were you gonna go?
Oh, I'm still thinking. I don't.
Okay. Well, I think that, I mean, really look back at the Iliad and the Odyssey, and it was, you had Achilles and his guys. I mean, his troops were like loyal to him. And I mean, and to an extent, them fighting without him was just not the norm. I mean, they're not going to go to battle without him. Because their loyalty is to him. And so his loyalty is maybe to Agamemnon, but their loyalty is to him. And it's when there's a break in the chain of loyalty that things start to break down, it seems like in the Iliad. And then even in the Odyssey, you've got, whether it's the servants within Odysseus' household that have remained loyal to him throughout the entire time of his absence, both with the war and with the journey back, or the loyalty of his men to him through the war and joining him on the journey back and that kind of stuff. It is much more personal in those cases, yeah.
And Odysseus's companions meet their doom because they're continually disobeying him.
Mm-hmm. So again, it's more about personal loyalty. Go ahead, Jude.
Loyalty to the leader.
Wait, are we talking about the Iliad and the Odyssey or cities? Do we shift?
Any of them all.
Okay.
we're kind of, it's fluid. It's very, very fluid right now.
Because, like, the Athenian government was democratic, right? So, or as democratic as things could be in the ancient world. So, like, it was, you know.
The idea was there. They were working on it.
Versus, and, like, Pericles was, like, a temporary tyrant.
Mm-hmm.
He was the big man there for a little while, but only for a little while. It wasn't like this institutional tyranny,
mm-hmm.
where people like pledge their allegiance to certain people to certain individuals. It's more like the people rule as a body for the
mm-hmm.
state to function.
Right.
So I don't know how under that system, like given, I mean. Besides the instance of Pericles and like other people who rose up to as like a central lawgiver,
mm-hmm.
ruler, I don't really know how you could have this like a personal allegiance to a certain person.
Right. Go ahead.
I felt like the guy. I don't know how to pronounce his name.
Thucydides.
Yeah.
Okay.
One.
Yeah.
I felt like what he was talking about and how it really strengthened the importance of loyalty and how
mm-hmm.
like solid it was and honorable in the culture in that time period,
mm-hmm.
from the Odyssey and the Iliad combined with this, it
mm-hmm.
it really seemed to like put that as one of their top virtues,
mm-hmm.
like because being non-loyal or being a traitor to whoever was like the biggest.
Right.
Shame and whatever, like you would be shamed forever and killed and all that.
Yeah.
So it seems like it's almost putting loyalty more important than, like, it kind of doesn't matter who you're loyal to as long as you're loyal to
somebody.
Because you don't get shamed if you're not loyal to the state, if you're loyal to, like, some governor, whoever, some person in power. But if you're loyal to nobody, then you're kind of like an outlaw and just, like, nobody.
Okay.
Are you talking about in Thucydides or in...
In, like, all of it. In all of the whole Athens, Greek culture thing.
Because,
like together.
There was that whole thing with Corcyra.
Corcyra.
Okay, Gorcyra. I know.
None of us hear this out loud, so you realize that, right?
Yes, I was just, okay, that's the one I'm least certain about. Okay.
I was just saying Coursera.
What happened with him? I don't know.
Well, so, because Coursera, from what we've read, right, we didn't read that much, but Coursera rebelled, or no, yeah, Coursera didn't want to be under the, what was it? There was this colony that they founded. Basically, they wanted, okay, it was with Athens, actually. Interesting enough. Coursera wanted to become, like, joined up with Athens so that they would be defended against Corinth.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Corinth
but
was also...
Athens was in league with Corinth.
No,
so,
Athens was in league
with
Athens, and Corinth was in league with Sparta.
Well, Athens had a league with the Peloponnesian League or something. Or, no, not that. They had an agreement or some kind of...
No, there's a treaty between
yeah.
Athens and Sparta. Athens was on its own side. Corinth wanted to be with Athens, but Corinth was on Sparta's side.
Yeah,
so
Corinth was on Sparta's side.
When they tried to put that together, it was the Spartan... It was the Athenians, because they helped Corcyra against Corinth, who was a Spartan ally. Athens was indirectly breaking the treaty by attacking
a branch
of Sparta.
So there was this idea
Athens complicated.
Abandoning its loyalty, but then it's also like, I don't know what I was trying to say.
It happens.
I guess it just strengthens.
Go ahead, Seth.
Bring up like king, demagogue, tyrant, oligarch. What about Lycurgus?
Okay.
So. I know we were supposed to watch a video about him. I didn't. But I know after he had established the laws in Sparta, he said, you'll have to promise me, swear to me you're going to follow these. And then he went away for 10 years and then died.
Yeah.
So were they being loyal to him or the state? And it's kind of like a mix.
Yeah. Well, it's definitely hard when you have a culture where the leader is so closely associated with the state, that where the two in some ways are very synonymous. But I do think that we are seeing that in this whole time period that we're talking about with these different stories, that we're seeing this shift. And I think you actually said in both the Smith and the Scanlon articles, I think both of those articles are kind of picking up on that, talking about that a little bit, of the shift from the individual into an identity, instead of identity as an individual warrior or as a leader of warriors with others under you, or your identity as a king over a group of people or over a city state or whatever, to the individual is still important, but it's also important that the individual is part of the group, and it's not so much I am judged on my individual ability as I'm judged on my contribution to the community. I think there's a shifting there, and more of a rule of might to rule of law, kind of being shifted, different, kind of a different perspective. I want to go back just a little bit to what Jack brought up at the very back then about the brutality and the what seemed to be like throwing everything out the window and acting like that.
I wanted to say that the plague kind of compares to the sedition in Corcyra.
Okay.
Like, there's the lawlessness, and, I found it interesting. The plague, it's no one's fault.
Yeah.
They're just... I forgot my... Oh, it was in my main reflection, not this one.
Okay.
It's like, they're being attacked by... Like, it was just a misfortune. And they were attacking each other in the sedition, Corcyra.
Mm-hmm.
But, it kind of, escalated, I would say, maybe. Like, here, they were just being reckless because they didn't know if they were going to live the next day.
Right.
So, he says, they regarded their lives and riches alike as a thing of the day. And then over here, they're killing each other left and right because they're scared and facing mass instability, mm-hmm. but they're also giving way to like their inner instincts, and but also like hate and envy and like paranoia and suspicion and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of reminded me, if some of the characteristics in the plague kind of bleed over into the revolution area, the revolution, I would say it kind of compares to the French Revolution.
Interesting.
Oh, yes, I caught that too. It was
like,
uncannily
like presented. They're like killing each other left and right, and they're like, these people need to go to death, and then both sides fight and just end up killing each other all anyways.
Right.
It's like the only moderation is extreme, and like you have to go to, you like allegiance to party is greater than allegiance to one another, and it's like,
yeah,
just crazy. Yeah, that part is interesting.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you had talking about that breakdown of the social order. So you think about, like, one of the things that has happened in, like, between going from the very progressivism kind of philosophy of the late 1800s, where basically coming out of the Enlightenment of the belief that, okay, yeah, we're just going to, science is king, science is God, we're going to just, through science, we're going to be making everything better and better and better and better. And then you hit something like World War I, where suddenly everything that, oh, wait a minute, no, we have just reverted, and this war is more horrible than anything. We thought that there would never be any war. We thought we had evolved past this. But now what's happening is in the trenches is more brutal than any war we've ever had. So throwing their whole perception of social order and of what morality and everything is, and their understanding of the world was built on, definitely through it. And that what was happening there in World War I set the stage for what happened with the Holocaust and everything that happened with World War II. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that was definitely talked about a lot in that time was the idea of existentialism, and that when you buy wholeheartedly into the existentialism, nothing is true, nothing is real, there is no afterlife, there is nothing to lead you forward, nothing to aspire to, that it does seem to, it leads to that whole hedonistic that eat, drink, and be merry because tomorrow we're going to die. And that was definitely coming out of what, especially like the younger generation would have been, because think about it, there were lots of guys your age that were fighting as soldiers in World War I and dying. And so they came back, those who survived, which were very few, came back. Those were the young people who fed the wildness of the 20s, of where what had been considered, no, this is moral and right living, this is what got completely thrown out the window we think of the 1960s as being 1960s, 1970s as being, yeah, free love. Yeah. There being the relaxing of moral standards, but the exact same thing had happened in the 20s. I mean, that was the whole flapper. There were a lot of other things playing into that, but the same kind of reaction was happening. When the social order breaks down, and in a sense, I guess maybe what people believed would be, you know, there's an expectation, and it is very transactional, but it is, especially if we are good people and we follow the rules, that life should prosper and things should go well. But when that is disrupted by something as devastating as like what happened in World War I, and you have the people's reaction that God, the whole God has abandoned us. We have the reaction is you have either people that go really, really strong, swing really, really strongly into legalism in response to that, or they said, well, forget it all, and they go all into, like, I'm just going to live however I want to live and no rules for me kind of idea. So I'm wondering, last week we were talking about the hero and the relationship with the gods, and some of you wrote about that in your journal for last week. Do you think there's any connection between what was happening with some of these situations and this sense of lawlessness? Is their perception of the gods and the gods' role in their lives, is there maybe their perception of fate or anything? Is any of that also changing?
I would say, like, I mean, I only know, like, barely anything about, like, the Greek philosophers themselves and what they thought, but, or...
You're going to get there.
We are going to get there.
You're going to get there with, like, Mrs. Crawford.
It just seems like they don't really care anymore.
Okay.
They're, like, they're just, like, the gods are more like a set of human standards that are placed higher.
Okay.
Than humans, if that makes any sense. It's, like... Like, it's not, I don't know. It's just being a good person is honoring the gods, I feel like.
Okay. But do you think that the idea, like what we talked about with, like, Achilles and Odysseus, where there's this sense of, like, okay, I've got to placate the gods so the gods will favor me, that kind of transactional, and it's going to be gods and the fates that determine the outcome of the war or the outcome of what's going to happen in society as a whole, do you think that that perception then is changing? That they don't see the gods as being that active in determining, like, what they are saying? Because I can see, like, if you go back to Iliad and the Odyssey, and granted, they are representing a society even older. I think they would see something like the plague as being, okay, what did somebody do? We've just been cursed by the gods.
Here it says,
is that perception that is the do you think that from what you read that are they perceiving the plague is, like you mentioned, Seth, that it was a misfortune,
yes,
rather than being
a curse
or a punishment from the gods?
Let's see, they,
and like wars are caused by strife and disagreements rather than like the gods trying to stir people up.
Oh, here is what it says about the plague. Fear of gods or law of man, there was none to restrain them.
Okay.
So.
So fear of gods is more like morality.
Yes. Synonymous with the law of man.
Yeah.
Being like a little higher form, older form of law.
So yes, you're not seeing... So is the perception of law also changing then? The law is not, okay, this is what the gods expect of us, and so therefore our law is following the gods. Now it's more...
Maybe...
Law is a social construct by the people.
Law is what forms a successful person.
Okay.
Maybe. Because everyone's looking for, like, fulfillment and happiness in Athens, it seems. And the laws... seem like they would lead you there to, like, the Athenian ideal life.
Yeah. Maybe. And also like, how can we function together so that the largest number of people can find that successful and prosperous life? Okay. What were we going to say, Jack?
I feel like after almost all the wars that I've read about, at least, that's right after is when the law changed. Like, World War One, it was, like, the 60s is when Playboy, like, came out, like, flappers and all that. And I feel like that was a way that law was changing afterwards, because they all came back and they were like, hey, my best friend died, or, like, all these people died.
Yeah.
And they seem to realize how, like, more mortal they are, and how easy and quickly people can die. Just like that. So they might have losing that, and then in World War II, if you watch videos of it, Mm-hmm. The mines, when they would blow up, it looked like a mountain just like came out of nowhere and blew everybody up.
Mm-hmm.
So like after that, there was a lot more of like sort of religious base, because like not religion, but like people would have more of a philosophy view after that, from what I understand, because after seeing that, they would often things like, because after seeing a mountain like show up like that and then fall down, seems to like that no man or no person can do that.
Yeah.
And so like I feel like after every war, everybody sees that and they're kind of awakened from their normal life, because they see things like that. How can people do that? And they see people die and they realize how mortal everybody is and how quickly, so they want to live the best life as they can.
There's definitely a phrase in World War One era, it says there are no atheists in the trenches.
Yeah, because they all...
Because it's like you're faced with your own morality, and there's absolutely nothing that you can do on your own.
Yeah.
And so they said there's no atheism in the trenches, that when it comes down to it, and you hear, like, if you hear the whistle, don't bother to duck because you're already dead. This with the speed of sound and everything, that it was like, if it's that close that you can hear the whistle of the bomb, the bullet or whatever, it says, yeah, don't even bother to duck. So it was so immediate in the fact that have you read descriptions of trench warfare?
Yeah, I love
and
I love
that kind of stuff. There's some really, really awesome fiction that's been written about that era as well, as far as just what it was like to actually be in the trenches and to have, like, because there was no way possible to, when you're constantly being bombarded like that, and so many times if it was a direct hit, there would just be shreds of human bodies and it, nothing identified. There was nothing that you could put into a coffin. There was nothing. It was just like minuscule shreds, and like they would talk about, like, yeah, after rain, you'd have a part of an arm sticking out of a wall, because that was all that was left of the person, but it had gotten, in the explosion, it had gotten buried into the wall. And so soldiers would go by and they would shake hands with the arm, the decaying arm that was sticking out of the wall. And there was a callousness that people, they had to basically just shut off their emotions just to be able to survive. And I think a lot of times when we have the plague, I think when it's something like that happens, sometimes there is that element of, there's the fear is so much that sometimes people have to just kind of totally shut down emotionally, because otherwise, yeah, they care for their family, but yeah, I'm going to pretend my family, I don't have any bandwidth to care that my neighbor's dying. And to do something. So yeah, I'm going to be totally okay if I have one neighbor that's sick and they just nailed my neighbor's house shut with their wife and their children inside, even though there's only one person in the house that's sick. And people were okay with that because they were, well, it's like if you nail them, and okay, yeah, everybody in that house is going to die, but maybe that'll keep my family from dying. And so there's a kind of a self protective kind of thing that shuts down in things in people's minds. It's like, okay, where am I? My loyalty first is to my family. So I can only deal with that. Okay, what were you going to say, Jack?
It also seems that, like, after that or doing that, that you see so much destruction, you see so much you kind of, like, hate and kind of, like, mm-hmm. dislike, kind of dulls, because in the trench wars, they were all the people were tired and, mm-hmm. like, because they weren't moving. And when they moved, they would die anyway. Mm-hmm. That during Christmas, yeah, I think it was Christmas, they all came out and, like, sang together with the Nazis.
With the Germans on the other side.
Germans,
yeah, because it wasn't Nazis yet.
That's just not Nazis. And then the next day, they started killing each other. But it shows that...
It was 2 weeks, actually.
They didn't actually hate each other. It was just, like, the people, like, they kind of just dulled. And they weren't...
Yeah.
Instead, they didn't have the fiery hate anymore. They just... They're doing what they're told, but they got out that one time.
Well, then we're kind of come full circle back to this idea of thinking, like to wisdom of making, of actually thinking about what is going, rather than just blindly following, but to actually thinking. And I think maybe that, like I said, it was just one of the things that just has stood out most to me is this idea of a going from Iliad, where Achilles, the hero, and his heroism was primarily based on his ability to fight and his loyalty to his men. And then we just see that keep being expanded and kind of morphing into from there to from just physical prowess to intelligence with the cunning and the wit and everything, to now there's much more emphasis on wisdom. And also it's like expanding the loyalty, I guess, to larger groups. Okay, I'm only going to give like maybe just a few more minutes. Any thoughts on the art? Like, one of the things I asked was that you read at least one of the two articles that were in. Did anybody have any comments on those around what you thought about the Scanlan? Scanlan was the echoes of Herodotus, where you're like, okay, if we put Herodotus and Thucydides, if we put the two of them in a room together, what do you think? Or is Thucydides building on what Herodotus started as far as thinking about the world in terms of history? Or are they more different than they are similar? And then the other one was basically specifically about Thucydides, and that one was more about his ideas about the how he portrayed characters and stuff. Yeah,
I had a question about that. Herodotus came first, right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, those were my question. So wouldn't everybody, like, isn't all history books and like history in general kind of built off the people before you, because you see what they wrote? Especially if they're old like that, you see what they wrote, and then you write, like, and it's all based off each other since it's history.
Well, I think it comes to like a. Sometimes they do contradict each other, because sometimes if you have people who are basically representing different sides, or if you have a historian from Sparta and historian from Athens, they aren't necessarily going to be building off of each other, because they're going to have more of a motive to make sure they look good. That their city state looks good.
Yeah,
but it was crazy because Thucydides said how he had the plague. It was like, I had it myself.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And he survived.
What?
And then he had the plague, and then he survived.
Isn't that how Pericles died?
I think. I don't remember.
And it's like in the first 3 or 4 years of the war, I think.
Yeah.
And the war's 30 years long. Like,
yeah.
We, like, barely scratched the surface.
Oh, yeah. We got, like, little tidbits.
Yeah.
It was very interesting how he went into the plague. I read that part all the time.
Yeah.
So interesting in like a weird, morbid way. How, like, so if he's, is that how he described it so well? He described it firsthand? Because it seems kind
of
weird if you're like,
a lot of it's described.
He's like,
yeah. You just look at people dying and you're like, how are you feeling? I don't know, you're popping up blood. Okay, and then writes it down.
Okay, now you're making him sound like what's his face from Princess Bride.
Oh yeah, like that.
the one who's in the Cat Rogan.
Takes 50 years off his life.
Yeah. Tell me,
wait,
how are you feeling?
Oh,
he's
the guy,
the
count.
Yeah, the six-figured one. The six-figured one.
Oh my gosh, it's a great movie.
Yeah.
I just thought it was interesting how they like the old people, the Hector and Homer. Homer also does that with the. With the.
Iliad?
Yeah, like with the vividly detailed injuries and stuff. That seems very.
Well, I think Thucydides is trying to show how horrible it was.
Yeah,
obviously. Not like Homer. Homer's trying to do it like art. He's like, this is. It was this violent. No, yeah. Thucydides is like
trying to enlighten us to make us appreciate how bad it was.
Yes, exactly.
Because if he said, "I just got sick and then I felt better," is there a plague? You wouldn't. You just be like, "Oh, it's a plague." But then if you're saying, you know, they were dying and coughing up blood and all that
yeah.
stuff, you'd feel like you'd there'd be more emotion to it than
yes,
just saying, "I got
exactly.
sick."
Yeah, yeah. Description of it is.
He wants to show why it was absolute pain. How
yeah.
it was absolute pain.
Sounds very bad. What was really interesting was that the animals could also catch it.
Mm-hmm.
Could also, because usually that doesn't happen with human diseases.
Yes, he was like, anything that touched or tasted a human body was gonna die.
I thought it was really funny because, like, people are always talking about, oh, you had, like, COVID, your animal can't catch it, or, like, the flu, or, like, all sorts of diseases. I've never heard of a disease that animals could catch it from you, or you could catch it from them.
Because it was, like, real poison.
Well,
like,
being transferred from animals to humans, I mean,
yeah.
you have bird flu, swine flu, there's a whole chicken pox, there's a bunch of them. So.
Not like humans can get dogs or animals.
Yeah, it's less common. Okay, well, we kind of need to switch gears here because we only have like little over 20 minutes left.
Proposal.
So we are that's the next thing that, so basically the last thing that we've got that's going to, because we've got, after today, we're not having class next week because of the Thanksgiving break, and then we have three classes back when we come back, and that's kind of what we need to talk about. We have one last project that we're going to be doing, and this final project, we're looking, it's definitely needs to be, like we've been talking about these other things we've been doing have been more in the five paragraph range, 2 to 3 pages. But this one's going to definitely be a little bit longer, minimum in that 4 to 5. If you wind up going a little bit longer than that, I definitely want to keep it. I want you to keep it under 7. So where this is going to be an exercise in choosing your scope of trying to make sure that you're coming up with an essential question that can be covered in. Shooting for that 4 to 5 page range, if it goes a little bit over that, but definitely keeping it under the 7. That's going to be part of the challenge with this, and that's why this time I am asking you to write a paper proposal. And so for a paper proposal, this is basically just identifying what we call an essential question. And since this is going to involve some research, I mean, part of your research is in the things that you've been reading all semester. For MANA, you also have any of the articles that I've given you as far as these critical articles, or if you want to, for you, you may decide that, no, I want to go out and do some hunting on my own, either for historical material to go along with the literature things that you've been reading, or other critical articles that dovetail with what it is that you want to write. So there is going to be some other research involved, and that's part of the proposal. So what the proposal is, the idea here is to the question that's in Canvas, how does one or more of the texts from our reading, and this is including everything from Genesis, Gilgamesh, Iliad, Odyssey, all the way through, I mean, everything that anything that you've read within MANA or that we've specifically discussed in here, and that's including the oral style, because I know that you guys are just getting started with that and the reading for that. So I don't want to make, that's definitely not a required part. But if there's something that you're doing, that there's something that you're discovering as we're reading and discussing with Mrs. Crawford related to the oral style that you want to bring in as part of your paper, you're most welcome to do that. But it's not required that you include the oral style in what you're choosing to do. But how does this reflect or illuminate a particular aspect of Greek or Hebrew? Or you can even go to where you're kind of contrasting the two, in a sense, like taking, like what we did with the biblical hero versus the Greek hero, if you want to take something like that and expand on it, or if you want to take some other aspect, like if you wanted to hone in on just the relationship between man and God, like man and the gods, Greeks, versus man and God in Christianity, if you wanted to just hone in on that, or if there's some other aspect, if you that you wanted to tie into that, but you're trying to pick some particular, so you're not trying to do everything, That's why it's like it really to keep it in the scope of what we're talking about. We really do want to keep some. We're going to need to have a fairly specific question. All right, and so the idea with all of this, you're using either or and biblical and or biblical text as a primary source, but then you're also going to have secondary sources, and part of those secondary sources, I do want you to investigate whether you actually wind up citing them or using them extensively or not. I want you to have two critical, I want you to at least look for two critical articles. And I said one of those critical articles, like I said, could be making use of the things that I've provided in class. Those are definitely available to you if they fit what you're wanting to do, but also going out and looking and exploring what else is out there that might be related to your essential question. So for the paper proposal, it needs to have an essential question. And that what an essential question is, it's something that you use to basically focus your research. Essential question is there to keep you on track. It's like when you're given, for an essay exam, you're given a prompt. You're saying, okay, this is the question. You need to answer this question. And you need to answer only this question and not go off on a whole bunch of bunny trails. It's supposed to keep you on track. So that's why that's the first thing I want you to do. And what I was hoping that, like with last week of trying to introduce this whole idea a little bit, was to think about, okay, what is it that I want to write about? What is it that stood out to me this semester about the worldview, about the way what's motivating these characters? Like I said, what is it that I really want to focus on? And come up with an essential question that's going to help you keep on track for that. So the idea of an essential question, it needs to be specific and it needs to be focused. It needs to be concise. Yeah, concise is probably a better idea. It needs to be. So like, for instance, you might want to choose. You can't have it like for this one. You could have something that's very character driven, like. For example, we've got one of the things that jumped out at me when I was going back and looking over the Oresteia again, because it's been a long time since I'd read it. I think about, oh yeah, you got a whole Agamemnon. We've got Agamemnon all the way back with our. We've got Agamemnon going all the way back to the Iliad. We've got Agamemnon. How is this portrayed? Like several centuries apart, how is this portrayal of Agamemnon as a king? How has that changed? I mean, there's things to play. Like if you want to have your essential question be character driven, like how is this particular character an example? Like if you wanted to take Odysseus and like focus on, okay, I really, really want to focus on Odysseus and kind of his identity as the head of the family or something like that, or if I wanted a family loyalty, if you wanted, so that's what I would want to focus on. So I want to create this essential question that's dealing with that. Or so it can be very character driven, but it could also be more thematically driven. Like if you want to take a concept like, say, justice. And you want to say, well, okay, over the course of the things that we've studied this year, how has this perception or the way justice is portrayed, how has that shifted from one, like if you wanted to compare the way, I guess it would be the Mesopotamian world of Gilgamesh, how did they see justice the same way that the Greek world saw justice? I mean, is there something there that you'd want to work with? Like I said, the relationship between men and gods. I mean, that could go, that's another one, the relationship between men and the gods or men and God. I mean, you could track. We basically have three different. You've got Gilgamesh's world, you've got the biblical world, you've got the Greek world. So if you wanted to track all three of those, could also work. So, yeah. What does it mean to be honorable? What does it, if you're going to do biblical, if you wanted to do just biblical, what does it mean to be righteous? Like what do we see as what entails being righteous purely based on the biblical accounts that we, and like I said, this is supposed to stay within the time frame that we've been studying. So, yeah, so if you're doing something this with the biblical stuff, we're looking at Old Testament way things are portrayed. We're not necessarily bringing in the New Testament because we're talking that's significantly later. Okay, so we want to keep that in mind of not drawing the New Testament shifts into that. So there definitely can very well be elements of comparison and contrast that go into this. As we're, like I said, like if you want to take your essential question and you want to focus on your essential question in one character in one book, yeah, you can do that if you want to keep it that narrow. There's definitely plenty of things that you can work with in these stories that you can go from there. If you want to show how a character has changed, for like if Odysseus from one portrayal to another, like Agamemnon from one book to another book, from one piece of literature to another piece of literature, those kinds of things. Or how is, like if you see overlaps between Herodotus and Herodotus and Homer, or Herodotus and Thucydides. I mean, there's a lot of mix and matching that can be going on there. But that's the whole idea, is coming up with a specific essential question, that this is the question that I want to answer. And basically, the answer to that question is kind of like the beginnings of your thesis. It may not be the final wording of your thesis, but it's the basic, that's ultimately where you're going to go, is the answer to that question. Okay? And so in the paper proposal, is at most one page long. Basically, I'm thinking two paragraphs. One paragraph is that, okay, this is what I want my essential question to be and why. Like, this is why this is interesting to me.
So rough draft?
This is the paper proposal.
Oh, I thought you said 4 to 5.
The paper proposal is just, you're telling me this is what I want this paper to be about.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's a proposal to say, okay, this is what I want to do. And so that way I can say, okay, yeah, you're on the right track. This is, I think you can probably do that in that approximately 5-page range. But it might, maybe if I'm looking at it and I say, yeah, you know what, we need to add something to that to maybe what you've got for your essential question can, well, that's more of a 2 to 3 page question. Let's see how we can adjust your question to make it more of, fit the scope better. Okay.
I can ask any question within like the Bible and what we've read within the time.
Within the biblical parts of what we've been reading for manna. So you've got Genesis.
Oh, so I can't ask about like Greek or whatever.
You can ask about everything, but it's a question you're going to seek to answer.
You're going to try to, it's a question that you're going to try to answer through your researching, and in you're going to answer that in your paper. Your paper is the answer to that question.
Okay, so I don't put my question in the paper.
No.
I just answer.
This is the question that's going to guide your figuring out what you're going to put in the paper. It's going to say, okay, this is what I want to say. These are from what everything that we've read and then other research that I've done, this is how I'm going to answer that question. And from all these different sources that you've been working with all semester. Okay. And so so the first paragraph is, what is the question and this is why I'm interested. The second paragraph on the paper proposal is like, okay, this is what I'm planning to use. So if you're saying, okay, I want to, out of the things that we've read in class this year, for here in manna, because we're going to do them together. These are the primary sources that I want to use for this. And then this is what I'm looking for as far as other research to go with what we've already done in class, what we've already been working with at this point. Okay? And so, yeah, so what's your plan for doing? So that's what I would like to see on, have you upload like on Thursday, because my plan is, provided I don't have any medical things that have to happen on Thursday, and my plan is to be there for class again on Thursday, and that you guys would upload kind of that one page. This is what I think I want to do, and so that way I can respond to that. And then all the main thing that you are responsible for coming back on the 28th is that you started to put together, figure out, okay, what research do I need to do? So start doing some research and starting putting together an outline. So you don't even really need to have started writing yet. I mean, if you have started, if you get inspired and you want to go ahead and start writing, great. I mean, if you want to work ahead. But I at least want to see your that outline and have an idea of what research you've done so far. Okay. And one thing that's going to be really important, this is going to have a works cited page at the end, and you are going to be citing throughout your essay. So as you're discovering what it is that you want to use as far as your sources, make sure you're getting your bibliography information and getting that down right away. Remember, if you're using something like JSTOR, or Academic Search Complete, or even Google Scholar, a lot of times on those, you can have it, can have like JSTOR and Academic Search Complete will generate the MLA bibliography for you. It can do so. Then you just get to cut and paste and save that for when you're putting your paper together. If you're finding it from somewhere else or you're doing a source that's not from one of those two, remember you always need author. If it's an article title or a chapter title or something like that, if you need the name of the book or the journal, page numbers, publishers, dates, those are the kinds of things that you're gonna need to make sure that you don't get into your paper and realize, oh, wait a minute, I don't remember where that came from. So if nothing else, if it's something you're finding online, make sure you save the URL. Because if you save the URL, we can go back and find the rest of it. So that's always helpful. Okay, we've got 5 minutes left. We don't need to necessarily make 100% decision on this today, but we do need to think about this. Because we only have 3 classes yet, and from what I understand, Mrs. Crawford is planning on having class on December the 15th as usual, and then you guys are going to have an oral exam kind of by appointment like on the Thursday of that week, which would be the 14th. So the 12th and the 4th. No, over, like one-on-one, like over Zoom or something. I don't know. She's got, but it's a one-on-one oral exam kind of thing. But that's going to be that same week, the 12th and the 14th. What we need to do is I want to make sure that I know that on the December the 5th, I want us to have a rough draft done by that point and a peer edit, just so that we can peer edit. I would like on the 12th, I would like at that point there to be able to have one more round, because since this is a longer thing than we've done before, I would love there to be a revised draft that could be peer edited or at least proofread one more time before the final. So that's right now, that's what it says on the in Canvas, is that the rough draft would be on the 5th with a peer edit. There would be a revised draft due on the 12th with another peer edit on the 12th being proofread, and then the final draft will be due on the 15th. The problem is, if we do that, if we use class on the 12th, which is the last day we're here in this building for the semester, if we use that day for an in-class edit, there is an exam. It's a short exam. It's probably only going to take you maybe 30 minutes. We'll talk about what's covered on that later, but where do we do that? So that's where I think we need to make a discussion. And like I said, we may not be able to make a decision on that today, but definitely when we come back on the 28th, we need to make a decision how we want to do that. Because I have some options that we could do an in-class final on the 12th. And then because we're using Canvas, we could do an online peer edit, that you would do the peer editing outside of class through Canvas. So that's one option. We could do the in-class peer edit, and then you do the test online. You do the test at home and upload that. And maybe we could talk about whether you do that on the 13th or the 15th. So we've got some options there of what needs to be done. So like I said, we don't need to necessarily make a decision about that, but whether to do the peer editing in class and test at home, or whether to do the test in class and the peer editing at home is kind of, or if you guys see another option in there. I do not see how we could do I would not want to try to cram it in to try to do both at the same time, even though in theory, I think the test should probably only take you 30 minutes. And in theory, you would be able to do both during our class period. I don't want anybody to feel pressured that they have to rush through the test because they have to do the peer editing. So that's my hesitation about trying to do both on the same day.
I think I would rather do the test in person.
I think I'd rather do it not.
I'll get anxiety if I have to do it like on my computer and stuff.
Well, then, like, you can take your time. Like, you can take it longer than if you
were in, I don't want to take my time. Because if I have a piece of paper that has questions on it, I'd much rather just...
If we did peer edit online, wouldn't we all have to turn it in like the same time? So we can all peer edit? Or would it...
Well... Everything would be your whatever your draft was at that point would need to be uploaded like on the 12th, and then I would assign peer editors, so we'd send up an invitation to edit to you in Canvas, and then you'd click on that, and it would take you to your peer editing person. You take it to their paper, and then there are tools in Canvas to where you can highlight things, add notes in the margins, underline, do it, all the normal things that you can do. As far as putting editing comments on those, that it's just all in Canvas. And then as soon as you're done, it automatically sends a notification to say, I'm finished. And they can go and look at comments.
Okay.
So that's available to us to use. It wouldn't be actually having to hand somebody else a piece of paper and edit that way. It would all be in Canvas. So like I said, think about it. We'll make the decision when we come back on the 28th.
Next week, Thanksgiving, right?
Yes.
Do we have Thursday class?
Thursday is Thanksgiving Day.
Oh, yeah, duh.
So, no. Yeah.
It's Wednesday.
No class next week.
But we have Thursday class this week.
Yes, yeah. Day after tomorrow. Yes, you have normal Thursday class for this week.
Don't we have something on 9 to 11?
What?
On Thursday, your dad's thing.
Oh, we might be doing that. I don't think he.
He emailed me about it.
Oh,
it's
today?
Thursday. No, last night I was.
Wait, is it Thursday or Tuesday?
I put it. It's the 16th. It's the 14th, 15th.
Oh yeah, he said that we might have to. He might have to talk to Mrs. Crawford.
Yeah, we have some.
We're out there because.
Okay.
He sent an email last night.
Yeah, that's
really late.
Yeah,
I saw it because I was up.
I was too. I was on the computer.
You have to get me to go to bed.
Like Tuesday night. It's like Tuesday night or something.
It's
like next Tuesday.
It's the 16th, 9 through 11. I have it on my calendar.
Yes, he said he would work it out with Mrs. Crawford.
Okay, well, just let me. So as far as I'm concerned, as long as you have that paper proposal uploaded Thursday morning, I will comment on it and give you the go ahead from there.
Okay.
As far as if there's anything I have concerns about your paper proposal, I will let you know on Thursday.
Okay.
So if it doesn't work out that I can actually be online with you guys at that point, that's the way we'll handle that.
Okay. So school actually ends on the 15th, right?
Well, the last day of class here is the 12th.
But then we have the Thursday class. Which
yes.
14th.
Yeah.
On the 14th.
Which means we probably got three on the 15th.
I usually say that, like, if my class, if there's anybody, any revisions or that kind of stuff, that make sure that gets uploaded into Canvas by the 15th is, like, the last day that I'll accept, like, revisions on other assignments and that kind of thing.
Oh, man, me and Dory are going to have a long week that week.
Why, what else is going on?
My little brother does theater with her. They're both actors.
Uh-huh.
And be part of the backstage crew.
Okay, that's cool.